Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
Well, for ordinary Indonesians, it's very serious, especially young people. The middle class is feeling the squeeze. There have been things like an increase in GST. In the regions, you've had increases in various taxes.
Decisions by the incoming Prabowo government in Indonesia to cut public services, raise taxes and award fellow politicians lucrative salary bonuses has incensed the Indonesian public, leading too many to take to the streets to voice their frustrations. Also on the program...
And this is a good one because it's a long eclipse. So in other words, the moon is going almost slap bang through the middle of the Earth's shadow. And that means that the blood moon part, the total part of the eclipse.
Not only are we looking forward to a spectacular event in our skies in the early hours of Monday morning, we will see what we know as a blood moon. Find out more about this rare event and stay tuned to The Wire. But first, there has been an uprising in the Senate as the Coalition, Greens and Independents have joined forces to push for the immediate rollout of the new in-home aged care package, which was set to be released in November. The calls have come after a Senate inquiry found that over 121,000 people were waiting to be assessed for in-home support, with the waitlist for approved recipients at over 87,000. James Bale asked Mike Woods, Professor of Health Economics at the University of Technology, Sydney, what were the promises and flaws of the current system in place?
The Labor government has put in place a new Aged Care Act that the whole parliament has passed. So that's going to include a whole number of reforms, some of which are to home care and some of which are to residential care. And as part of bringing those reforms and the new act into place, the government also promised that there would be an additional 83,000 home care packages to help reduce the wait list and the time taken for people between when they're assessed and when they actually get assigned a package. So that was what the promise was. Since then, a whole lot of the regulations relating to the new act were not fully developed, and the government put off the start of the act until 1 November this year rather than 1 July, which obviously didn't happen then. But at the same time, which surprised a number of people, they put off introducing any of the additional 83,000 home care packages. So people are having to wait, those who are already been assessed and waiting to get a package, having to wait 4 months rather than start on 1 July. Now, what's happening in Parliament, of course, is that they're focused on this issue and said, well, there's still 2 months to go to 1 November. How about we release 20,000 or more of those packages now anyway?
Other than the handling of the rollout, is there any other flaws within this in-home aged care package system that has not been addressed yet?
One of the other pieces of information that's been revealed through this process of the Senate calling a short, sharp inquiry is that there's also been a very substantial increase in the number of people who are not only assessed and waiting for their package, but actually waiting to be assessed. Now, normally that might take a month or so, but we found out in evidence to the Senate inquiry last Friday that, in fact, there are over 120,000 people who have lodged a request for assessment and are waiting for that assessment to occur. So, not only do we have the 87,000 who are assessed and are waiting for a package, but we've got another 120,000 saying, well, we've put in our application to be assessed. These are people in their, particularly, in their 80s and the like, who've got various frailties or other requirements that might need care and support, saying, well, we've put our name down, but we haven't even been assessed yet. So once they get assessed, they then have to wait further to actually then get assigned a package. Then they have to wait another month or so to actually organise the provider. So
have you spoken to anyone in the community with first-hand experience of the flaws that are currently going on?
When you're in the sort of age group I'm in, a lot of us are dealing with parents who are in wait lists. So, yes, some of my colleagues are experiencing that exactly at the moment. But rather than relying on anecdotal evidence, there's enough official data that demonstrates how long the wait lists are. For instance, the average wait list at the moment across all packages is between 9 and 12 months.
Say if these amendments do not pass in the Senate, what are some of the ways that politicians, the Greens, independents can support Australia's aged care community in the future?
It's certainly important for Parliament and other stakeholders in aged care to keep across what is happening and to be vigilant in that and to hold whichever government is in power at the time to account for their actions and their delivery of quality aged care.
Professor Mike Woods, Professor of Health Economics at the University of Technology, Sydney, speaking there with James Bale. The Leukemia Foundation revealed on Monday that blood cancer is one of the most urgent and under-recognised women's health issues in Australia, despite being the second most common cancer diagnosed in Australian women. As we mark the start of Blood Cancer Month this September, Maeve Groom asked Bill Stavresky, head of research at the Leukemia Foundation, why blood cancer in Australia isn't being talked about.
Yeah, one of the key reasons for it being under-recognised relates to awareness and knowledge levels. And our research does show is that awareness around blood cancer is very low. Only one in five women are aware of what blood cancer is. And even more importantly and disturbingly, the results are even lower for awareness around signs and symptoms. For a cancer where prevention or screening is not possible, it's important to know what signs and symptoms are and look like to take immediate action. Without that knowledge, without the awareness of what to look out for, the delay in taking action and commencing treatment really doesn't have an impact on outcomes.
You mentioned that you cannot prevent, screen, or reduce the risk of blood cancer. Are there any signs women should be looking out for if they can to detect this early, or symptoms that may be commonly overlooked?
There are common signs and symptoms for blood cancer that women really should look out for. And the problem is some of those signs and symptoms can be quite common with many other conditions. And these include unexplained weight loss, unexplained bruising, recurrent infections, excessive fatigue. So irrespective of whether you've had a good rest, the fatigue and tiredness continues, but also swollen lymph nodes around the neck, armpit and groin region. And whilst they are the common signs and symptoms, what our research has shown is that women tend to delay any action, not going to see their doctor. And one of the key reasons for that is really they can mimic many other conditions, even things like the flu. Part of the message that we're trying to bring across is don't delay, don't hesitate, take action immediately, go see your doctor and ask for a blood test. But importantly, if you are diagnosed with blood cancer, it's all important to start treatment as soon as possible, as outcomes are much better this sooner treatment starts.
Could you talk to us a little bit about the immense toll a diagnosis of blood cancer takes on the lives of sufferers? How does this condition affect women physically, emotionally, and financially?
Blood cancer has an impact more than just the physical side. It's not dismissing the long and intensive treatments. For some blood cancers, treatment can go on for not just months, but over years. And so that's one aspect. And generally what's overlooked is the emotional side, the financial side. Financially, it means time off work. It means having others to look after you and support you, which might require them to take time off work. And the research does show is that the personal side, the out-of-pocket costs, are quite significant and up to $11,000 per annum. But more so than that is the psychological and the emotional distress. It means time away from family, time away from friends, particularly for women living in regional areas who might need to relocate. But the other fact is that because of the treatment and the high level of toxicity for some of the treatment, it could impact on fertility and the ability to have a family later on in life. And with the leading cancer amongst young Australian women and girls, that impact is something that's not really spoken about, but does have an immense toll on women.
It's Blood Cancer Month this month, which also coincides with Women's Health Week this week. How does blood cancer in women compare to more publicly discussed cancers, such as breast and cervical cancers? What needs to change for blood cancer to be recognised as a health priority in Australia?
Blood cancer is one of the conditions that really hasn't received as much publicity and public attention, but it is a cancer that impacts women of all ages. And for that reason, we are seeking not only the increase in awareness and understanding around blood cancer, but also the continued support and investment in key areas. That includes research, but also importantly, the investment needed to continue that support for women who are going and battling through blood cancer. And that support is the financial support, the accommodation support for women who need to move closer to hospitals, as well as that professional support, the emotional support that's needed to support women through their day-to-day battle with blood cancers.
Bill Stavrisky, Head of Research at the Leukemia Foundation, speaking there with Maeve Groom. In Indonesia, public frustration about the increased cost of living and the administration of government has spilled out onto the streets with mass demonstrations across several major cities. This would boil over into violence following revelations that the police ran over and killed a 21-year-old motorcycle rideshare driver, Afan Kurniawan. Stephen Hill asked Professor Vedi Hadiz at the Asian Institute at the University of Melbourne whether these protests indicate a serious disconnect between the government and the public in Indonesia.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think that the government assumed that the public cuts would just be swallowed by their population and that business would continue as usual and that the perks given to parliamentarians, basically to buy off their votes for the president, will just be ignored. But that's not what happened. It has already escalated. The heavy-handed measures being ordered by the president is a direct response. The point of it is to actually contain the protests. And to some extent, it has been successful in that. Activists that I've spoken to say that they're taking a break to size up the situation. Two things that they are worried about. One is that the military and the police have the permission to respond to them in a more vigorous fashion, meaning violent. And also, they don't want to be unwittingly entrapped into what is partly a conflict among elites.
So this is happening at a time when the size of the Indonesian middle class is shrinking and there's increased concern about the cost of living, but the Indonesian economy is currently stagnant. How serious is the economic situation for ordinary Indonesians?
Well, for ordinary Indonesians, it's very serious, especially young people. Youth unemployment has always been high, or maybe I should be more specific, underemployment. Even educated youth starting to think that their futures are pretty grim. And as you say, the middle class is feeling the squeeze. There have been things like an increase in GST. In the regions, you've had increases in various taxes, such as property taxes. It is all in the midst of what seems to be continuing corruption, abuse of power, businesses enjoying privileges.
So a lot of the criticism has been levelled on the political elite across the board, with former leader Jokowi's son appointed vice president for Prabowo, a move that was interpreted by many Indonesians as giving a stamp of approval to the former defence minister. With these protests, is there any fracturing of this political alliance between Prabowo and Jokowi?
Oh, it's fractured. It was an alliance of convenience. Jokowi wanted a way to maintain his influence after he stepped down. An alliance with his former archenemy, Prabowo, was a way to do that. And his son was like the offering. I'll bestow upon you my significant political machinery.
So can the opposition organise around a coherent platform? I mean, with particularly now that the PDIP is in opposition, is there potential for a different coalitions to form to challenge?
PDIP is not in opposition. It's not a formal part of the coalition, but it says it will work with it. And there's a reason for that. The head of the PDIP, Megawati Sukarnoputri, is, can I say this, utterly pissed off with former President Jokowi, who was a member of a party but has committed treason.
The last election.
By supporting Prabowo and that were not approved by Her Majesty Megawati. What she's going to do is cozy up with Prabowo, because currently they have the same enemy. That's Jokowi. So another alliance of convenience. If they succeed, that alliance will not necessarily last either.
Professor Vedi Hadiz at the Asian Institute of the University of Melbourne, speaking there with Stephen Hill. At 11 minutes past four on Monday the 8th of September, a spectacular blood moon total lunar eclipse will be displaying across the skies of Australia and New Zealand. This is where the moon darkens and then turns into a beautiful rusty red colour. Thomas Kutis asked Professor Jonty Horner, an astrobiologist and astronomer based at the University of Southern Queensland, what makes this event so special.
Well, it's the first one we've had in a couple of years, so people have been kind of crying out for something nice to see in the sky, I guess. And this is a good one because it's a long eclipse. So in other words, the moon is going almost slap bang through the middle of the Earth's shadow. And that means that the blood moon part, the total part of the eclipse, which is really the bit you want to be going to see, is pretty long. It's going to last for a little bit more than 1 hour, 20 minutes. The one downside is that this is an eclipse for the early morning. So you need to get up in the early hours rather than staying up in the evening to see it. But otherwise, it's just going to be great.
So can you explain why the moon turns red during a total eclipse and what determines the intensity of that colour?
Well, there's a few things going on. The moon is going around the Earth while the Earth's going around the Sun, but its orbit around the Earth is tilted a bit compared to the plane of our orbit around the Sun. And what that means is that if you imagine the Earth is casting this big shadow into space, as that's the light it blocks from the Sun. Normally when the moon is full, it will go opposite the Sun in the sky, but it will pass above or below the shadow. So it doesn't go into the shadow when we don't get an eclipse. But when we get a total eclipse like this, the moon and the Earth and the Sun line up perfectly. And so the moon dives into the Earth's shadow. And when you have the total eclipse phase, that means that the moon is fully immersed in the Earth's shadow. And from the point of view of somebody, if you imagine that you were stood on the moon looking up at the Earth in the sky, the Earth would be blocking the Sun entirely. You will get no direct sunlight. But what you would see is you'd see a ring of red light around the Earth. And that red light is essentially the light of every dawn, every sunrise, and every sunset all around the Earth combining, where the red light from the Sun is being scattered through the atmosphere and bent towards the moon, but the blue light and the yellow light are scattered out by the atmosphere, which incidentally is why our sky in the daytime is blue. It's why you would see when the Sun is right at sunset, you see it looking quite red, but on a dusty day or a smoky day, the Sun looks redder than normal. So you know that the atmosphere changes how much of the light gets scattered and how much gets through. So from the point of view of the moon, when it's deep in the middle of our shadow, the only light reaching the moon from the Sun is being bent through our atmosphere like this. And so you only really get the red light coming through. So that's why the moon turns red, because we're seeing it, of course, by reflected sunlight. And the only light reaching the moon at that time is red light.
What advice would you give to first-time eclipse watchers? Any tips for getting the best view or experience?
The beauty of things like this is they are predicted in advance. So we know exactly when the full eclipse begins and when it ends. So there are great websites like the Time and Date website where you can get those timings for your local place down to the second. So the time for this eclipse is going to be about the same all across Australia. Just depends on your time zone, how you adjust it. And the reason for that is that the moon is going into the Earth's shadow, and anywhere where you can see the moon, you can see the eclipse. So the total eclipse part, the part where the entire moon will be going blood red, begins Brisbane time at about 3:30 a.m. and finishes at about 4:52 a.m. And that time will be fairly constant all across Australia. But of course, if you're in a different time zone, you need to adjust for that. What that means is that you know exactly when to look. You can set an alarm and get up early and go and see it. The other thing I'd say, though, is if you are somewhere where it's cloudy or you're somebody who struggles to get up early in the early hours of the morning, all is not lost because we do have another blood moon, another total lunar eclipse coming early next year on the 3rd of March. And where this eclipse that we've got in September is an early morning event. It's quite a lengthy event and a bit deeper. The one in March is an evening event. The full eclipse in March begins at about 9 p.m. And so if you're more of an evening person and you don't get to see this one, don't worry, there will be another one to come in just 6 months' time.
Professor Jonty Horner, an astrobiologist and astronomer based at the University of Southern Queensland, speaking there with Thomas Cooters. Australian Molly Picklum has secured the title of World Surf Champion at yesterday's World Surf League finals in Fiji. The 22-year-old from the New South Wales Central Coast claimed victory in the first heat, defeating the 2023 former world champion, American Caroline Mark, and she's the first Australian to secure the title since Stephanie Gilmore's victory in 2023. Ruby Ward asked Glenn Hall, professional surfer and surfing instructor who previously trained Picklum, what were his feelings upon hearing of her victory.
It was a special day yesterday watching her achieve her first world title, and crazy to even think that there can be more, but at such a young age to already be world champion it was a pretty proud moment.
Yeah, and you yourself, you're a professional surfer on the WSL World Championship Tour, spending 10 years travelling the world. What kind of lessons have you learnt along the way?
I was fortunate enough to travel on the tour myself competing, and then continued after my own career to be on tour coaching for 10 years until this year. I actually took the year off to spend some more time with the family and not be travelling as much. So, yeah, I learned a lot of lessons. And, travelling the world, you obviously organically learn a lot about the world, and I'd be grateful for the opportunities we have and Molly to be on that journey together. And, you know, we first years on tour and then to the Olympics and travelling to the highs and lows of winning and losing. And, yeah, all those moments create so many lessons.
How's this experience helped you to become a better teacher? Because it's quite close quarters, it's quite grueling, I can imagine, emotionally.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely trying to manage and learn how to deal with those highs and lows. And I think as surfers, we're naturally resilient through constantly chasing the unknown. You know, we can travel from one side of the world to the other for a surf event and have no idea what the waves will be like. Obviously, with hope that the waves are good and the results are good, but you can get there and the waves are terrible and you lose first heat and you go the next day, you want to try and chase some waves to kind of let off some steam and catch some waves, and there's no waves to ride. So this weird feeling in surfing that you're always open to the unknown and okay with that, and travelling, you miss flights change. It's just, as a surfer, you organically have this ability to deal with change.
Is there like a certain type of personality that's you found more drawn to surfing? You say you kind of have to be more resilient.
Yeah, I think curiosity is probably one of the characters in a lot of surfers. You're curious to find out what is out there when you paddle out. You're open to however it may play out, but you're okay with that. And your curiosity of seeing what you can do with a moving piece of water, and go to bed hoping that tomorrow is something, but being curious enough to get up in the dark and run down the track while the sun rises and see what's there. Yeah, curiosity and that's what surfers are ingrained with, you know, chasing an adventure.
So she started her surf journey on the Central Coast, where you are teaching as well. And the local club she was a member of cheered her on at home. How important is the concept of community in the surfing world?
Community for everyone is the main thing that builds character and builds support. And in surfing, it is something special that when, say, Molly paddles out at a local beach, there's everyone from an 8-year-old kid trying to catch their first waves to a 7-year-old surfer that surfed their whole life. And the fact that you share those spaces with such a variety of people and different skill sets and all different journeys in their life, I think that surfing has a pretty cool piece of connection and community in that space. You'll be hard to find a surfer that isn't grounded by their community.
What can someone who's never surfed before expect from a surf lesson?
A surf lesson, depending on your own goals, it could be an older person who wants to ride their kind of ticket off the bucket list and ride a wave, and that can be solely just the experience of getting in the ocean, and that could be pretty new to a lot of people. For young kids who want to, you know, pursue this as a new sport and just they're interested in learning about the ocean. But I think the one thing that everyone has to kind of sit back and appreciate is the ocean is its own thing, and we've all got to learn to read that and respect that.
Professional surfer and surfing instructor Glenn Hall speaking there with Ruby Ward. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.